welcome to We Central. Today we're talking with John Hammer, Senior Associate Pastor at Sunrise Christian Center in Everett, Washington. John is the author of the book Exit and the founder of Represent Conferences. I had the opportunity to meet John in 2014 during a men's event in which he openly shared about his addiction to pornography and about how he was able to overcome it through the use of his faith and the loving support of men and family members in his life. John is a passionate and creative communicator that is living for a Jesus awakening in his generation. He expresses his heart and creativity through preaching, teaching, writing, blogging, and spoken word poetry. This is Eric Gomez, your host at We Central. Let's get into our conversation with John Hammer. John, I thank you for just the chance to have this conversation about really today's topic, which is the intersection of masculinity, pornography, and fatherhood. But I want to start off by just asking about you and your background, right? I just want to hear about you. Okay. I want our listeners to be able to get a sense of just who you are, where you come from. As a counselor, this is kind of a typical question, but I'm going to ask you anyways. I mean, tell me something about your... Tell me about your family background. I mean, where do you come from?
My parents are both first generation like Christians, and my dad was a pastor when I was born. Ever since I've been was born, he was a pastor, and so my parents didn't have a Christian upbringing, but they both had some like radical life changing encounters with God in their 20s and became followers of Jesus, and my dad became a church planter. And so I grew up in a pastor's home, and when I was a child, they planted a church, grew up in Christian school, and they provided a very loving home for me. I'd say I had like a good relationship with my parents. I mean, I agreed with them most of the time. We got in arguments, and we had typical sibling fights, and you know, probably like everybody's family. Absolutely. Growing up,
I understand.
But a good home environment. And when I was about 13 years old, well, maybe 12, starting middle school, 7th grade, I had was exposed to pornography at Christian school. And so I had seen like maybe one kind of vague advertisement in 6th grade, and then in 7th grade kids started bringing like pages of ripped out pornography magazines to school because nobody really had internet when I was in middle school. I'm 35 right now. But people really started getting internet, like maybe a few when I was early in high school, but then I graduated in 98. So like maybe like 96, 97, that's when I recognized it at least. Everybody was starting to get internet. I think we finally had internet by like my last year of high school.
Really?
Or the first year after. So kids were bringing, like, they were printing out, those that had internet early were maybe printing out pornography and bringing it or just ripping out a magazine. So I got exposed to pornography in middle school and got very curious about it and just started, like, hearing what kids were talking about. And I would never really pretend like I was interested in what they were saying. You know, I would never act like, hey, this is fascinating. So I would...
Yeah.
I would just draw away and go home and start exploring and looking for things. And really, by the end of middle school, regularly just pursuing sexual fantasies, pornography, masturbation. I mean, it was like it became a real addiction in my life. It's something that I woke up for every day thinking about, how am I going to find this? How am I going to satisfy these desires? And it really started consuming my life from that first, you know, year or two of middle school. And then going through high school, community college, just full on looking for every way but to fulfill my lust, but secretively. You know, like somebody else would bring like porn or say, hey, let's look at this porn thing or do something like that. And I'd be like, you're such a pervert, man. Come on, I'm not going to do that.
Right, you would say that.
I would say that. Yeah, so I would act righteously, you know, outwardly, like I'm better than you, but then I'd be at home trying to find the same thing that they were trying to show me, you know, because it was a very secretive, hidden thing for me. So I'd go to church and act involved, and I did think about God and spiritual things and wanting to get good grades and please my parents and be an upstanding citizen, you know, on the one hand, but I definitely had a totally dark, kind of depressed, sexually charged, kind of secretive life as well. So it was a very much a double-minded kind of time period for me.
I want to ask, so you get this initial exposure, like at, you said, around 13 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
You seem to have grown up in a pretty caring, loving environment. And yet, did your family have any sense of what was going on?
There was one time, my parents talked to me, I think, around the time I was 13, and had, like, the sex talk, the birds and bees talk.
You had
the talk. And had me, yeah, the talk. And they had me read a little bit of a book from a Christian, like, psychologist, and had a talk with me. But I felt like what they shared with me, I had already heard a fair amount from friends, you know. So what they were sharing wasn't totally new. I was interested, and I felt like it was actually helpful what they were saying. I think I was, like, probably awkward at that middle school age and acting embarrassed. But I was actually appreciative of what they shared. But I think it was a little late, you know, and it didn't address pornography or things like that. And I think in their mind, they probably didn't even think I would have access to it because they had a somewhat controlled environment in the home. You know, I wasn't getting it. I didn't have internet at the time. I didn't, you know, it wasn't prevalent. And if your kid's not bringing it up, you're probably not sitting there thinking, like, I wonder who's showing them porn this week. You know, it's just not usually what parents are thinking about with right. their kids, right?
Right, yeah.
At least at that time. And so my dad did catch me once. Like, he saw, like, a catalog that I had ripped a picture out of, and then I threw it away later. And he, so it wasn't, like, full-on pornography, but it was still, like, hey, I was going through some stuff. Like, he was building a fire or something, you know, and he's using paper and news things to, like, start the fire, you know.
Exactly.
And he's like, who did this? And I just kept lying. And he's like, he even pulled me aside. Son, you know, like, was this something you can talk to me about? I'm like, nope, I just didn't want to talk to him about it. I just lied and lied and lied until he quit bothering me about it. And then he just let it go. You know, no, it wasn't me. I don't know what you're talking about, Dad. You know? So I just kept it to myself. And I mean, I didn't talk to any friends, any pastors, any mentors. I mean, a lot of good positive influences in my life, whether it was school, church, family, but I just kind of, like, kept the lid on it.
So they talked to you about it, right? They had a conversation with you about it,
mm-hmm.
or about, at least to some degree, about sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not necessarily about pornography. Is that
right?
Okay. And yet your dad, he finds this page, right? And it's something he asks you about. And you lie about it, right? You yep. deny it to right. the point where he just kind of gives up.
Right.
And just stops asking, is that right?
Yep.
But you know that behind the scenes something else is really going on. But I guess my thought is if you'd had this conversation with him about sexuality, why do you feel like it was still hard to maybe fess up about kind of something else? Like, oh yeah, I saw this page, or why was that still difficult?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, sometimes to this day, I still don't know why I waited so long to open up. Because there were times where I really was like, oh, I need to get help with this porn addiction. Like, this is getting really bad. And I still feel like, almost like I need more insight. Why? Because when I eventually did, and when I was 20, almost 21, really open up and share with my dad what was going on and ask for help, he was so helpful. I remember even those first couple months of starting to live a transparent, vulnerable life, just sitting there being like, almost beating myself up, like, why didn't I do this sooner? Like, what was I thinking? This has been the best thing ever to actually share, to be vulnerable, to let someone in and not be rejected. Not that he was happy with what I had been involved with, but to let him in, and where he accepted me. He didn't accept the behavior that I was in, but accepted me as a person and as his son, and said he was going to be there for me and help me. And he would even get stern with me sometimes, but it was in such a loving way that I knew he was there trying to protect me and help me.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So it was like, and I started learning, like, this is what I've been longing for. I mean, porn is this false intimacy, right? It's this, like, I'm in a place where I get to pretend, I get to fantasize about what it would be like to be with this woman. And oh boy, in the middle of that fantasy, you're loved and you're the center and you're powerful and she wants you. And then all of a sudden now, like, in a relationship with my dad, I'm like, someone wants to help me. Someone wants to pay attention to me. Someone's showing me value. Someone's knowing me. Porn can never put its arms around you and love you back and actually fulfill that place of intimacy. But I was, I and again, I, I had a good relationship with my dad, but there was so many walls up to go to the deep places that it wasn't a great relationship. And of course, when I did open up, which I don't know if I can attribute to anything but the grace of God, as to why I did that day, right. You know, I was like, this is what my heart's really longing for, you know, and that connection with God. Mm-hmm. And that connection with my dad and with other people, you know, because it definitely affected my friendships and the way I interacted with other people. And everything at that point changed when I started opening up.
As my conversation with John continues moving forward, we begin discussing the book he recently wrote called Exit. His book is a unique and very personal look at his story in dealing with pornography and how he, over the course of pursuing his Christian faith and being vulnerable with other men in his life, was able to be set free from his addiction to pornography. Let's listen to John as he continues to share his truly compelling and heartfelt story. You had a quote, I believe it was somewhere in the introduction, actually. I want to read just a snippet of that.
Okay.
And I want to get your feedback because I think it ties in really well to what you're saying right now.
Okay.
So this is what you had put, and I just thought it was incredibly profound. You said, "My dad and several other men with whom I began to confess my sin and talk about my emotional problems didn't reject me at all."
Mm-hmm.
You said they were proud of me for being honest and taking responsibility for my sin. At the same time, they were never easy on me or let me think it was acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they corrected me, but mostly they encouraged me, challenged me, and most importantly, loved me.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Totally.
That's how that went down for you.
Mm-hmm.
So you enter into these deep places, finally, right? Mm-hmm. With them, with your dad in this case.
Yeah.
But you're not rejected.
Right.
Something else happens. It seems like it's an experience of love that you...
Absolutely.
Have. Okay, talk about this more.
Well, when I first went to open up to my dad, I, looking back, you know, hindsight's 20/20, right? looking back, not knowing it at the time, but looking back, I saw... I went over to one of my best friend's house at the time. He's like a big brother to me, and I was over at their house like 3-4 days a week. Just I'd show up unannounced all the time. We'd eat together, hang out, and I had some other friends that had moved out of the area. One of them rejected me with like a nasty letter, and there's since been reconciliation in that friendship. Another friend just moved out of the area, and they were like my two closest friends. And I had friends. Other friends and whatnot, but like I would spend a lot of time with my best friends, you know. So they were gone. And then I had this other guy that became like a big brother to me, and I just love hanging out with him and his family. And I drive to his house, he's gone. He's not there that night, which I showed up all the time unannounced, and sometimes they're just not home because I didn't ask, you know, are you guys doing anything, you know? So,
right.
But I just like this feeling of loneliness. Or like my best friends are gone now. Todd's gone tonight. Like so, I drove to a couple places that sold porn that night, and I looked around and didn't get anything. I didn't buy anything. So I go home when I was living with my parents at the time. Well, I'm a community college student, and that's the night I opened up to my dad. And I just remember sitting in Todd's driveway before I went to look for these places that sold porn and whatnot, and just feeling this rejection or this sting of like, I don't have any friends. I'm alone. I need something to feel better. And when I got home, I was in my room in my basement and I walked over to my dad where he was watching a TV show because I really just got hit with like this fear of God or just this awareness that I need help. I have a big problem and I need help with it. Yeah. And so I'm like trembling basically, and I come out and say, "Dad, I need you to talk to me." And that's when I start to crack the door open. And then the next day I shared even more. And then the next day I shared even more. And he prayed with me from that first night, and he loved on me, and he said, "Son, of course I'm disappointed to hear you've been doing this secretly, and I don't know why you didn't feel like you could come to me earlier, you know, but I love you and I'm gonna be here for you. And he prayed with me that I would be free from this and it wouldn't be a problem and that God was gonna help me." And so I just kept feeling like, okay, I shared, like, I think even the first night I told him I only drove to one place because I didn't want to tell him I went to two places, which when you're being honest about your sin and you're not getting rejected, why would you fabricate such a little lie? You know what I mean?
Right.
But that's where I was at. But I was cracking the door open. You know, it was new. I'd never really lived transparent ever since, you know, as an adolescent from like 12 years old all the way up to now being, this was right before my 21st birthday. I never really lived transparent with people and been authentic or been vulnerable, right? So now, so I'm cracking the door open and he's showing me love. And so I'm like, hey, that wasn't so bad. That was helpful, I think. So the next day, I'll share a little bit more of what I've been doing.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then the next day, a little bit more. And every step I did that, he just kept loving me, and he'd listen, and we'd pray, and he'd encourage me. He'd give me like, hey, I think this book will help you. I think there's some certain passages in the Bible for you to read. So I'd start reading those passages in the Bible. And then we just spent a lot of time talking. And I would call him from work sometimes when I was feeling under a lot of anxiety or a lot of shame, because that was what happened for me, actually, was the porn and the masturbation habitually stopped, like, that first month. Like, I might have slipped up a couple times that first month, and then literally after that, like, it was just gone. The behavior was gone.
Really? Just gone?
It's the grace of God. I mean, we prayed for the power of this darkness to be broken off my life. I went to the scripture. I started filling my time with, like, listening to uplifting music, listening to spending time at church, spending time with men that were like, were just really solid guys, really like godly men, full of love, full of life, you know, good in their field and business, like just solid guys. I started spending time around men that would encourage me and they would love on me and they'd always like just a lot. Some of them were my dad's friends or just different men in the church, you know, and they would really just pour into me. And I'd start gaining confidence. But I started dealing with a lot of shame and self-hatred. So the behavior stopped, but I was like, I really hated what I did and who I was because of all the past sin, sexual fantasies, pornography, all this stuff. And I knew I think God kind of intercepted me at a fork in the road where I was really starting to plan, like, hey, I'm going to quit, like, just being in porn and fantasy world, and I'm just going to, like, have to, like, leave the church and start, like, now I'm going to start being with women, and it's just, like,
yeah.
I can't keep going, like, double-minded. I can't go one foot after God, one foot after wholeness, one foot after purity, and one foot into, like, fantasy and lust and porn and all this stuff, right? So I think that's really when God intercepted me, was in that place. So I was dealing with a lot of that, but with that shame and self-hatred of all the past. But it was really a lot through mainly my relationship with my dad, but there was definitely like, I mean, I even dedicate my book Exit to like, I think it's like 7 or 8 men,
right?
Because they were all there for me in that first period of me walking with Christ and walking in freedom. And helping me undo all that shame and self-hatred that I was under. And it was through their love and encouragement that really made a big difference.
Your book really seems to highlight this component of freedom, that an individual who's dealing with something like pornography can truly have hope around this notion of being free, right? Like,
right.
This isn't something that has to encapsulate the entirety of their lives, right? There's a breaking out point.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as you talk about this, there's honestly multiple elements that really stand out.
Right.
So I'm actually really excited to get into all of those things. But I want to kind of take each one in segments and then work with it, okay?
Sure.
This first part is this element of your faith. I mean, to this point in the conversation, you've referenced this multiple times. And I also know that not everybody listening to this is going to be coming from a faith-based standpoint, but I value you and I value your perspective on this. So I want to hear about the faith side of it and I guess what it's meant to you in this process of change, I guess.
Right. So being a pastor's kid and going to Christian school, you're in Bible class 5 days a week during the school year.
5 days a week?
Yeah. You know, you're in church, obviously, as a pastor's kid, at least twice a week, usually Wednesdays and Sundays in my context. So a lot of Bible knowledge. We read the Bible as a family, so faith was very central to my life. But I think it was at this time of my life, too, where that faith wasn't just my parents anymore. When I experienced this freedom and started to really open up and ask God for help and ask my dad for help, it wasn't really just my parents' faith anymore. It was like the gospel, the good news of who Jesus is, like, became very, very real to me.
Yeah.
And became central to my life. And I really started, I had had times of relationship with God. I mean, I lived with so much confusion and double-mindedness that I could be, like, reading my Bible every day for, like, a few minutes, you know, and thinking about God. I wonder what I could do at church. And then an hour later be, like, trying to check out women and try to run to the corner store where they would maybe let me look at something I shouldn't be allowed to look at age, like, 16, you know.
That's right.
Or whatever, like,
yeah.
So in the same day. But so faith was there, but it wasn't central. And when I experienced this freedom, I really started to pursue God. That's when I first felt really a calling, like, I'm supposed to be a pastor like my dad. And that's a whole other story that would take a while to share, how God, like way beyond circumstances, but just, like, I believe, like, supernaturally is, like, confirmed, this is what I want you to do with your life, you know. And all this stuff started to come into being. I never wanted to do that before. I mean,
really?
My parents never painted the ministry as a negative thing or something that I shouldn't want to do, but they never told me, you're going to be a pastor one day, or you should really consider this. And they never painted it negatively, but I was just like, I can make more money doing something else. And
yeah, this really wasn't, you know, in your mind, right?
I'm going to endure all the things they've endured, even though they put a positive light on it.
Yes.
It still is a lot to go through and a lot to face when you're working with people like that.
Right.
So,
okay.
I was like, but this became, like, Jesus became everything to me. And it was actually in a conversation with my dad where I was still really feeling like, Dad, I honestly don't think I can go to heaven anymore. It's because this self-hatred and this shame was really deep. And to share this story just to illustrate, you know, like, this is where I was really at. And faith was the central role. Having an understanding of truth in God's word, like, really unlocked the deep root for me of this self-hatred, this self-punishment. So I think deep down, I don't know if it's like a firstborn tendency and I want to perform and always be your best and measure your, you know, it probably is. I know I'm talking to somebody who's
a
counselor,
yes.
A therapist, right? Feeling so bad about myself, and every time I read the Bible, even there would be some good things I would get out of it. And this is post porn. This is after living in porn for a couple of years, and I'm in Bible school now, and I'm feeling like every time I read the Bible, I'm seeing God's judgment. I'm seeing a God who's angry at me. I'm seeing the one who's done the unpardonable sin. I'm seeing the one who's insulted the Spirit of grace, the Bible says. The one who's trampled the blood of Jesus underfoot. There's, like, these certain scriptures that are definitely interpreted differently by different theologians and teachers of the Bible, but I would interpret them in the most positive, negative light towards myself. Like, so I'm convinced I'm going to hell. I'm convinced I sinned so much knowing what was wrong and breaking the heart of God that there's no way he could ever let me back. And so I would deal with this constant torment of anxiety, hearing almost, not like audible voices, but almost feeling like I'm hearing voices internally just accusing me of how bad I am and how broken I am. And even if I'm going to do good for a while, I'm ultimately going to screw up everything. So don't you dare become a pastor, John, because if you do, you'll end up looking at porn again as a pastor, and then you'll get exposed, and you'll hurt all these people, or you'll do some big immoral sin, and you'll hurt all the people that looked up to you. You'll be an influence, and then you'll shatter everybody's hopes. And I mean, even writing the book was a little bit of that. Like, do I put that out there? Like, what if something,
right.
Is this
no,
real
totally,
to me?
Man. Right.
I mean, I wanted to walk in freedom for a while before I shared what I was learning because I wanted it to be real. So, anyway, I'm in this conversation with my dad one day, and he's encouraging me, he's loving on me, and I'm, like, yelling at him, Dad, you know, like, I'm done, I'm just going to quit Bible school, I'm going to quit pursuing being a pastor, I just, I'm tired of it because I'm probably just going to screw everything up. I'm such a failure. You know, this is how I'm seeing myself, feeling what I'm thinking.
Right.
And my dad's like trying to argue with me like, son, God's not done with you. That you can have hope. You're not doing this stuff anymore.
So he provided hope. Right. He was trying to provide
right. you hope. Okay. That's what we're arguing about. I'm unforgivable. I'm unlovable. And he's like, that's a lie. You're forgivable. You're lovable. You know, and he asked me this question. It was like a breakthrough question for me. And it was all about faith. And that's why I bring it up. He said, son, do you think there's anything you can do to add to the blood of Jesus? To add to what Jesus has done for you? Or do you think that's enough for you to be forgiven and accepted? Or do you still think there's something else you have to do? And I was like, there's got to be something else. And the whole central tenet of the Christian faith is that man isn't good enough to redeem himself and that has been in sin and has rebelled against God. But in our rebellion, God doesn't treat us as enemies. He laid down his life for us and he loves us so much that he gave his son for us. And what his son Jesus did on the cross is what makes us acceptable to God, right? So that we're loved and forgiven by receiving the free gift of Jesus. So my answer was completely contrary to the core tenet of my Christian faith.
That's right.
And I didn't really, I would never put that answer on the Bible school test. I knew it in my head that that's the wrong answer. But it was like I got squeezed that day from all the pressure I was under. And that lie was exposed. Mm-hmm. And I was able to start dealing with the root that I believed ultimately that what I did made me unlovable and that what God did for me wasn't enough. And once I realized that was a lie and that was a faulty way of thinking, it was a real turning point in my relationship with God and in my view of myself. And that's why like faith is, yeah, definitely so central, because when I believed the truth of what God's word said, mm-hmm. it unlocked me from this big mess I was in.
You know, I hear you talk about this, and I get this vision in my mind of you sitting there with your dad, your father, right? And he's seemingly really, in a sense, like fighting for you, right? He's getting these counter arguments from you about like why you're so bad, why you're gonna go to hell, all that stuff, and yet I can just see him just like being with you and just like really trying to provide you with some answers, but also just in a sense kind of rescue you from. Yeah. Some of what you were going through. And I really wonder what this conversation also says about men who struggle with this aspect of being open.
Yeah.
Right? Because you were going to those deep places,
mm-hmm.
in this case with your dad.
Right.
And, you know, as a counselor, I talk to a lot of guys, they struggle to go to those deep places, right?
Right.
Especially when they're talking about a subject like pornography. They don't want to do it. And here we have the story of you with your dad, right? You. A young man, your father, a more mature man, right? And he's together with you. What is he telling you as a father, as a man? Mm-hmm. What is he conveying to you? What message is he sending to you, essentially, right? Like, in this conversation with you, besides just this element of faith and where you stand in God's eyes, what else do you think he was trying to send to you around maybe this aspect of masculinity? What was he saying?
Yeah, I mean, I think he was always a model to me of being vulnerable. And he would always share from his heart. So he would apologize if he felt that he did something wrong as a dad, even with tears sometimes, you know, or he would express difficult things that were happening at the church sometimes and ask us to pray as a family. So he modeled, I think, besides just being there for me in those specific instances,
yes.
He modeled for me, like, you need to open your heart. You need to deal with things. You can't bottle things up. You can't stuff things inside. He grew up as a drug addict and alcoholic and went through a lot of tragedy because his mom died when he was little. And there was a lot of family trouble and, you know, three different stepmoms and, you know, all these different things he grew up with in his life. So I was always used to hearing his story. My dad was very authentic. So people tell me this all the time still that know my dad. Oh, we just took it. Some people just got back from a trip, for instance, of traveling overseas with them. And they go, man, it's so refreshing to be with your dad as a pastor and a leader. Like, he's the same everywhere he goes. Like, who you see up on the pulpit, like, he's completely the same.
He's consistent.
So he doesn't have, like, a persona of being on the stage that's different than just like talking with him, like, you know, at the grocery store or at the house. And
yeah,
so he modeled just being transparent, just being yourself. I mean, I never wanted to ultimately reject God because I saw it was so attractive to me. Like, look at my dad's life. He came from total brokenness to, like, I mean, he was literally labeled paranoid schizophrenic by one of his counselors when he was in addiction. And he's, I mean, I've never known a dad with addictive tendencies or, you know,
right.
He's like, he's to me like the definition of steady, mm-hmm. stable.
Yes.
He's emotional. Like, he's a very passionate person. But he doesn't make decisions driven by emotion. You know, he's very stable and he helps people and he's got tough times like the rest of us, you know, and he'd be the first to say that, you know. Wow. He's a down-to-earth guy. But he modeled something that, like, when somebody lives with integrity and God's blessed their life and they help people and they've overcome great odds, I mean, why would you not want what he has? You know, so both my parents were, like, very loving, very supportive. So I think he...
Yeah.
And I saw it even in his friendships, the way, like, other men that you would respect, like, they respected my dad. So you see even in his friendships, because some of it, his friends became some of the people or people that he mentored, they became people that helped me in those first 2 or 3 years mm-hmm. as well. So yeah, I'm hugely grateful for his influence in my life.
You know, I think it's tragic that in today's world there's not always a great deal of fatherhood present in the home. I mean, as a pastor, you hear about this, no doubt,
right?
Quite a bit. Again, here we have this conversation with you and your dad, but your dad's present, and in a sense, there's a model that you had about what it means to be, in a sense, a father, but also in a sense, what it means to be masculine. Mm-hmm. And a lot of guys don't have that. Again, even in the counseling office, I hear men who, they want to have more clarity around the sense of identity, masculinity, right? But right. It's a situation where they often don't have those models and they're questioning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what does it mean for me to look like as a man? What is the sense of masculinity going to play out like in my life? They often don't know. And again, I hear you have this conversation and I'm just truly, like, I'm moved by that because it's an example of what can be, but it's also counter to what often is.
Right.
And so when you talk about something like vulnerability, and guys are in our American culture, and vulnerability seems to be the last thing that they're receiving, right? So I've got to ask you, what messages do you feel men are receiving mm-hmm. from things like pornography about what it means to be a man and vulnerability and all of those things? Like, what do you see happening there?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's a great question. Because I see it a lot as a pastor and as somebody who's interested in these issues to help men. Because my dad, like, he grew up in a sports family. And, like, so we grew up in a sport. We were a sports family. We watched, you know, the Seattle sports team. We've been Seahawks. My dad owned Seahawks tickets the first year they were ever a team. My uncle still owns season tickets ever since they've been existence. You know?
Yeah, right.
So football, basketball, baseball. It's just, like, so very much driven around, you know, your performance. Like, sports is all about your performance. Do you win? Are you better than somebody else? Can you beat someone, right? So there was definitely a side in our home of, like, we played sports growing up, we chopped wood, we helped my dad mow the lawn, and he's very manly in that sense. He's had a beard ever since, you know, my whole life, my whole existence. He's never not had a beard ever, you know. And people are like, you look so much younger if you shave. He's like, I'm not going to sell out, you know. So there is in a sense some, like, traditional, like, American masculine things that I've picked up or that my dad demonstrated. But so he was very manly in a sense, and he would even say, you know, like, and maybe he's quoting somebody else, like, yeah, I'm in touch with my feminine side. I put my arm around her every night when we go to bed. Speaking about, like, my mom, right? Like,
that oh my was gosh, his, yeah.
His wife was my mom was his feminine side, you know. But yet he was very in touch with his emotions. Like, he's not ashamed to cry. He's not ashamed to share how he really feels with people. I've even seen it now working with him on a pastoral staff that he'll be vulnerable. He's a very strong leader, but he'll open his heart in front of his staff. I've seen him shed tears in front of staff members exposing how he feels about something, but he's not like, that wouldn't be very often. He's not like all over the place emotionally, but I'll see there's times where he is like, hey, I want to be very transparent with you. This is how I'm feeling. And so he's modeled, I don't know if you call it, like the tough and tender or the compassionate samurai, you know, like he's a strong man. He's got goals. He's got vision. He's responsible. He loves sports. He loves people right. performing at their best, but that's not at odds with like crying sometimes or sharing with someone how you feel, listening, encouraging. Yeah. So he's, to me, it's been a very refreshing model where he's demonstrated a life, and it's what I believe, like, we put certain things at odds. Like, if I'm tough and I perform and I'm going to achieve great things in this life, I got to be, like, ruthless. And porn and just kind of the macho male
right.
message.
Yeah, what is that?
Is, you know, that you use women and you're in charge and people serve your needs. And it's much different than the Christ-like picture that we see of servant leadership, that you love your wife by laying down your life for her. You know, and I saw that in my dad's. I saw that in my dad's life. I saw the way my dad treated my mom when she went through about with breast cancer, you know, and the way he cared for her and the way he emotionally supported her. And it was beautiful, you know, even through the midst of tragedy, to watch that kind of sacrificial love and the way he honors my mom. It's awesome. So
that's so different, though. That's contrary. So, that's not what...
So different. And I think the world is... Right? I'm hearing a lot about, you know, the negatives of the macho male. So I feel like the culture is either, like, kind of in the porn, like, let's use women. I mean, I've, you know, heard some of the most disgusting things that guys say, obviously being a guy, growing up in this culture, radio programs, media programs that just say the most derogatory things about women. You know, you're trying to basically collect how many women you could sleep with, like, they're just here to fulfill men's sexual fantasies. And I'm saying these, of course, in a much more, like, sanitized or sanctified way.
I know you are.
But, right? But,
totally, completely.
But, so there's kind of that message. And then there's also, I think, the like, well, that's inappropriate that men dominate and use women and degrade women, which is true. But then there's kind of like, let's make men more like women. You know, like, they should be more soft and they shouldn't be so driven and they shouldn't. And sometimes it's like, well, I feel like the culture wants to then the answer is to try to make men more like women. And it's like, I don't think that's really the answer either. I think the answer is to uncover what is the intended design for true masculinity. And I mean, we're on masculinity, and that would be true about femininity too. You know, so let's recover what is healthy masculinity. And I think there is certain aspects of being brave and wanting to conquer and wanting to protect and provide and be a leader. And, you know that what you have is, like, it's manly. Like, I think there's something that resonates
right.
that's, I believe, it's God-given. I believe it's hardwired into our nature. Maybe other people would say the hunter-gatherer, the caveman. I don't know, but I think according to God's intention in creation, there's something in there. But that's not at odds with listening, serving people, putting others first. One of the things that God gave me, in language at least, that I just realized maybe even in the last couple of years was, I feel like God and other people actually know me now. And I think that's what the false masculinity robs men of, is that no one knows them, like really knows them.
Yeah, there's a wall.
They put all these walls up and they act like, you know, they find whatever their niche is, you know, whether it's good... business, sports, music, creativity, or it's all these different subcultures we have. They find their identity and they try to become the best they can there so that they're like, the people they're trying to impress are pleased with them and won't bother them. And they'll be like, oh, well, you're really good at this or that or whatever. But like, I'm known when I'm transparent, like someone really knows me and then chooses to still love me, even though they know me, even though that includes my flaws or my sin or the things that are even shameful or the things that I'm still growing in, and they know me, and like that bond of trust and that true like community, that true family, that bond, yeah. like
uh-huh.
that, like, I mean, just talking about it, it moves me because it's so real to the, I think, the core need of who we are. you know, as a person. We need someone to know us. And that false masculinity robs us because we start projecting something that's not really authentic. And when we do that, when we are authentic and we are transparent, and then we find those times where we find those places that we do want to call them connections or relationships, mentors, pastors, whoever it is, right, that accept us in that place and are there for us, wow, there's nothing like it. And I think that's even when you find a band of brothers, if you will, when you find those people on a common mission with you, and it's like a truly healthy, like, brotherly love, where, like, these are my brothers, these are my friends, they're my family, like, we'll fight for each other, we care about each other. And hey, if one of my friends found out I was, like, planning to do something that hurt my wife, you know, like, they'd be on my doorstep. They'd be like, what are you doing? This is in violation of who you are. You know what I mean? Like, they may not say they're going to kill me, but, like, you know, it's healthy to have those people that love you enough at times even to get in your face a little bit and say, dude, don't check out on this.
But there's a vulnerability attached to all of that, though, that you're really highlighting, right? Mm-hmm. And I think guys see vulnerability as a weakness.
Right.
And they don't see vulnerability as a strength. So I'm just wondering I'm wondering how you characterize it. Do you see vulnerability as being more of a strength than a weakness?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Vulnerability is definitely a strength. And I think...
Yes.
And again, I think we pair certain things together that aren't actually true. So we say being vulnerable means that you're, like, always emotional, mm-hmm. meaning you're always emotionally unhealthy and you're pouring out your problems to everybody all the time because you're trying to be vulnerable. Like, that would be unhealthy. One of the guys that mentored me in my book, John Fuller, that I talk about, who used to be a pastor in our church, you know, he said his mentor used to tell him, localize your failures and globalize your success. And he's like, if you want to live with, like, kind of a healthy mindset and be mentally, emotionally stable, you do need to actually identify your failures, your weaknesses, your sin, your shameful areas, and you do need to deal with them and talk to people about them. But that's, like, localized at a narrow place. Just find a few people. You don't one person, three people. You know, you don't walk around and tell everybody about everything you're going through all the time. But then you got to tell most people about the good things that are happening in your life. And then it helps you think, become more hopeful, you know, more thankful, more full of faith for what the negative things you are dealing with. When you're talking mostly about what good things are happening, what good things God is doing. So vulnerability, though, is a strength. I just think that sometimes we've equated that it means you're gushing your issues all over the place all the time.
Yes.
And I think there's a way to be vulnerable, a way to be real, but not be overly specific with certain people that maybe you can't trust.
Yes.
I know there's times where I did try to trust certain people, and then they started telling me about all their problems that seemed way worse than mine, and I wasn't prepared to hear their stuff, and I kind of felt like, man, they weren't really prepared to hear my stuff either. And so I learned wisdom over time, like, I don't need to talk about my problems every day. I mean, even my dad had to talk with me because I wanted to get better so fast that he was like, son, sometimes I just want to go watch a sports game with you, or can we go to the movies, or, like, can we just talk about something good? You know, you keep wanting to overcome, and I appreciate that. I'm going to be here for you. But you can't build your life only around negatives, you know?
Absolutely.
So I think vulnerability, though, is a huge strength. And it allows you to be sober-minded. It allows you to have a clear perspective, and it allows people to speak into you. And I found that when I was vulnerable with the lies and stuff that I believed, and the things I was battling with in my mind, is that sometimes it was somebody else's belief for me that got me to where I needed to be. So, like, they would say, you're interpreting the Bible wrong when you say that. I mean, what do you mean? And, you know, like, no, look at this verse. And they're like,
right.
Well, you're taking that out of context. You don't understand that.
Okay.
And so then they'd say, this is how God sees you. Or my dad would always say, this doesn't have the fingerprints of God on it. This isn't the fingerprints of my Father in heaven. You know, this isn't how God speaks to us, son. How do you know? I'm hearing this. I think God's trying to get me to see this. How he's judging me. No. And they, over time, and to see if I was never vulnerable about those things and I just bottled them up, I would never have got the benefit of their knowledge and their years of experience and had their stories of how God got them through it. Because it was,
yeah,
when I saw myself through their eyes and heard about their victories and their struggles. So if I would have stayed to myself and not been transparent or vulnerable, right, I would have been at the mercy of my own reading, my own understanding, my own knowledge. But that allowed all of this truth to flood into my life. And that really started building strength around me. And I started thinking, man, okay, if they really haven't given up on me yet, and I keep talking to them, and they really have a positive view, like maybe I am seeing it wrong. But it was that vulnerability and transparency that even made all that possible, yes. Right? So if you're not transparent or vulnerable, you're just kind of stuck to your own devices. And I think that we're our biggest challenge, we're our biggest problem. We get ourselves into a mess.
Yes.
And we need God, and we need the help of others to get us out. So if we're not transparent, we're just relying on self only.
Yes. Okay, so I want us to get ready to close at this point. Mm-hmm. And in doing this, I wanted to see if you'd be open to doing something for me that we didn't necessarily talk about before, oh. But I want to hear you read it, right? Again, it's in your book.
Okay.
And you wrote this, I don't know if you call it a poem or a song.
Right.
But I just wanted to see if you would read that for us, right?
Yeah.
I just would love to hear it in your tone, from your lips, right?
Okay.
Would you mind doing that?
No, yeah, I could do that, totally. I have a YouTube video of too, as well, like, of doing it with a backing track and everything. But yeah, it's like a spoken word poem, you know, like slam poetry type presentation. And
heck yeah.
It was kind of just something that I do somewhat regularly, and so I wanted to express my heart, on the topic of leaving porn behind. So I wrote this letter, Dear Pornography, and it was kind of like weaving my story into the piece, but then kind of trying to give like a rally cry, if you will, to people that are like, I just want to be done with you. Like, this is who you are. This is what you do. You're exposed, like personifying porn, which, you know, even sometimes the Bible personifies sin at certain times, you know, and gives us that picture. So like just personifying it as like this enemy of like, hey, I used to have a relationship with you. It's kind of like a Dear John letter, you know, and now I'm done with you.
Yeah.
And I want to see everybody be done with you. So yeah, this is that was kind of the heart and intent behind why I wrote it. So
that's so cool.
Here we go.
All right, here we go.
Dear pornography, what beautiful photography, you twisted psychology. You once befriended me, told me I could call you porn for short. You lulled me to sleep like a mother rocks a baby, injected my soul and put me under a spiritual anesthesia amnesia. But somehow it was so deceiving, I thought help I was receiving. You offered me power, but then you became my master. Sin never looked so good as I was led to the slaughter, like you got someone's daughter and destroyed her innocence for a generation of malcontents. Yeah, you dress things up real nice, but no matter what you say, you are wrecking women in abusive slavery as you deceive them into false glory. You're in the corner store, on the web, in TV, you're even in the church. You once had a place in me, and it's escaping me, breaking me, to think that I gave you time, a dime for this crime against humanity, for lying vanity. You were my security. I wouldn't let you go. I couldn't let you down. I was afraid of losing you. Oh, the irony of Stockholm Syndrome, feeling at home with a blood-sucking vulture. You got women to measure by you their value, so now they can be sold to the highest bidder. No one considers them being abused, raped, and damaged, but airbrush and surgery create a false advantage, because the pain doesn't go away. It's not reality. It's just a play for crappy pay. And porn, you even got men forsaking their legacy, thinking their strength is sexuality. So the sons, brothers, husbands, and fathers just start wrecking destinies as they're slaves to these fantasies. I know the story all the while. See, I gave you an inch, and you took a mile. You have tainted the culture, destroyed marriages, and caused children to be left fatherless. I gave you my youth, and you gave me guilt, shame, and death. Took away my breath. But at death's door, I was awakened by the hand of a heart beating, bleeding love. See, porn, I'm actually writing to inform you that I found the exit, or rather the exit found me. Christ is the exodus from pain to porn to purity. Jesus is the way out. Some say a crutch. I've found him to be a strong tower. He surrounded me and he founded me, unbounded me. See, you have been replaced, porn, by the resurrected life. The way you led and I died was eye candy laced with cyanide. But my pain's been robbed. See, the gospel isn't just some band-aid job on a soul that is hemorrhaging from immorality. My neural pathways were retraced. My rejection was replaced. So pornography, you're not so dear to me. And though you make money by the billions and get clicked on by the hundreds of millions, I will tell my story of redemption because I can hear the sound of the masses marching to the master, making the exit. Signs in sincerity, this your dear enemy, a sinner made saint.
Folks, this is John Hammer reading from his book, Exit. I encourage you to check it out. John, thank you so much. This has been an honor.
Yeah.
I've truly enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you very much. I hope it's helpful to people, and I appreciate the opportunity to get to share hope and healing that's available for us.
Thank you so much.